Subcommittee on Elections will come to order. A quorum is present. Senator Pappas, Senate File 661. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File, I'm going to explain briefly Senate File 661, and then I do have an author's amendment to add, but I'd like to explain the bill first.
Okay.
A little unusual. Then we'll explain the changes. Section 1 of Senate File 661 requires all post-secondary institutions that accept state or federal financial aid to prepare a list of students enrolled in the institution and residing in Minnesota and provide it to the Secretary of State. Section 2 will authorize the Secretary of State to provide a process for online registration. Section 3 is a conforming amendment. Section 4 makes changes to the law specifying the form of voter registration applications to reflect the authorization made for online voter registration. Section 5 requires the Secretary of State to ensure that their website can provide voter registration confirmation to a registered voter. And Section 6 requires county auditors and municipal clerks to enter information confirming that an absentee ballot envelope has been received on a searchable database on the Internet so that the voter who cast the absentee ballot is able to search the website to determine whether it's been received. So that's what the bill does. And then we needed to make a few changes, one for MNSCU on the A1 amendment and the rest for the Secretary of State. The first part of the amendment really allows that the central office at MNSCU can provide the list of students enrolled in institutions. It doesn't have to be done by each institution. That's at their request. And the rest of it, Beth Fraser's going to explain, I think, some technical changes.
Senator Pappas moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. So, Beth, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State. The rest of the author's amendment, as Senator Pappas said, does make mostly technical changes. The new language on lines 1.5 to 1.7 adds an effective date for the voter registration confirmation so that you can check online that that's not effective until we have certified that that functionality is available. Section, the next new language, we're adding two sections to the bill which do two things. First is it says that municipal clerks may only be designated to administer absentee ballots if they have the technological capacity to do so and if they've received training. And we need to do that in order to enact Section 7, which requires the use of the statewide voter registration for recording absentee ballot applications and whether or not they've been received. Again, that section would only be effective after the Secretary has certified that the system has been tested and can perform the necessary functions. We need to have people using the system in order to provide for the online service so that voters can check to see whether their absentee ballot has arrived or not. If everyone's not using the system, then we wouldn't have the data available.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest?
What's a ballot board?
Ms. Frazier?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, a ballot board or an absentee ballot board is an entity that can be set up by a municipality or a county to process absentee ballots so that they're accepted or rejected by election judges prior to Election Day.
Ms. Frazier, do many counties do this now?
Madam Chair, many counties do use it. Under the legislation we passed last legislative session, counties are required to use an absentee ballot board to process the overseas and military ballots, and many do choose to use it for the domestic absentee ballots as well.
Madam Chair, Ms. Fraser, is there a statutory reference to what a ballot board is that you can give us?
Ms. Frazier?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, I need to ask Mr. Bodern to look it up. I think it might be 203B.13.
Madam Chair, Ms. Frazier has hit the nail on the head. That's right.
That's it?
Madam Chair.
And Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to make sure, because I know you have proposals coming with dealing with absentee ballots, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That the only thing that this is dealing with is being able to get those absentee ballots on the website, as opposed to changing policy with regard to absentee ballots, which Senator Sieben is going to have in her bill. Is that?
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, similar language is proposed to appear in Senator Sieben's bills, but it's also needed in this proposal for the absentee ballot checking to work.
Okay, I just want to be careful that we're doing technical conformity as opposed to making a big policy change with regard to absentee ballots in Senator Pappas's bill, because we trying to keep absentee ballot issues, whether we support them or not support them, as far as possible in a single policy bill with regard to them. Yep.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, it's up to you where you'd like to make the changes. If you want to make the change allowing voters to go online to see the status of their absentee ballot, I believe you need to make these other changes. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to instead put that in one of Senator Sieben's absentee balloting bills, that would be another option for the committee. But that's up to you.
Okay.
I'm fine with leaving the way it is right here. Ms. Frazier, will you just clarify how the Secretary of State certifies that your website works? What's the process? It seems like you maybe don't need to say you're certifying that it will work, but could you explain that, please?
Madam Chair, the effective upon certification is something that has been used with our office several times since the Help America Vote Act was implemented. This is, I guess, the first time that it says that we would certify that the website has been tested, but and perhaps different language should be used. But we did want to say that this would only be effective after we have tested it and ensure that it's working. And a firm date is not necessarily conducive to that.
And do you have any estimate as to how long this will take to get up and running, or when is it? Are you pretty confident that your office has the capacity to do this?
Madam Chair, we are confident that our office has the capacity to do this. I would need to talk to our IT staff about the timing. It will depend to a great extent upon how many different technological changes we're making, how soon they could get, how soon it would happen.
Am I not correct that other states are doing this now, so it's not like you're developing new systems or new processes that will have to be developed?
Madam Chair, yes, many other states are doing most of these pieces. The statewide voter registration system that we have here was designed in-house. It was built in-house, and I would need to talk further with our IT staff to provide you more information about how many hours it would take.
Senator Pappas, would you like your next testifier to come forward now?
Sure.
It looks like it's, would Mr. Ritchie, Mr. Secretary, would you like to testify on this bill?
Yes, please. Madam Chair, if that would be okay.
That'd be great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State. I just wanted to briefly add that one critical component of this bill, the online lookup and the online voter registration, was the subject of a lot of discussion at our national meeting of secretaries of state. Two states, Arizona and Washington State, have been the pioneers, have had this going for a number of years. Extremely successful, not just with young people, but of course young people were part of the discussion. But both the Secretaries of State of Arizona and the Secretary of State of Washington, and I just might add parenthetically, both elected Republican Secretaries of State have been extremely positive about how this has helped reduce the cost at the local level and also increase the accuracy, because the handwriting of many people has continued to be as poor as it has been in the past, and so when it's done online, it's much clearer, and it has provided much cleaner list, and a number of politicians have spoken about the advantage to them in terms of, you know, direct mail and that kind of thing. So there was just a lot of very positive talk by the people who have years of experience with this about this as a kind of next step in having very secure and very cost-effective voter registration lists. So that's all I wanted to contribute. I would take any questions, but I just wanted to add that piece.
Thank you.
Do you have any comments about the student section?
Madam Chair, the wonderful students who are here will be speaking to the student section, but it has been my pleasure to have met with a lot of heads of some of our colleges and universities and administrative offices, as well as with the student groups and the county election officials in counties where we have concentration of students, Blue Earth County, Mankato, et cetera. They're all very anxious that we move forward on this proposal, because it will clarify and it will help bring a lot of closure to some of the open kind of open loops that have been. There also is interest in many parts of the state in looking forward to some of the electronic poll books and some of the new things we have that really do make elections less expensive, more secure. And these kinds of services from our universities can help greatly enhance our capacity, you know, to help bring some of those costs down, but also just have better system. And I know the students have very specific things that they want to add to, you know, to that in their testimony today as well.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Senator Rest.
On the sub 5, and this is either for the Secretary or Senator Pappas, is it the case that any individual can request the status of anyone else's absentee ballot? Is that public information, if they can provide that individual's name, address, and date of birth? And I think we can't have individuals requesting there, so it has to be, can't be an individual, it has to be individuals. We need to make a grammatical change there, but
Madam,
how is that?
Madam
is
Chair,
that information protected in any way, and if so, why and how?
Madam Chair, Senator Ress, under our current system, it's $46 to buy the database of all registered voters, and that's available only for political purposes. But you know, it can be purchased by, you know, anyone with that intention. The online voter registration lookup systems that I've seen have been very carefully designed to protect people's identity. And generally speaking, you have to go through a number of different levels before you can find out. And what you're finding out is, are you registered and is your address correct? And so that's the information that's being provided in the lookup part of this proposal. So right now, your voter registration information in a very limited way, name and address, are available to anyone with $46 who buys the diskette. Under this system with the lookup, there would be another added element of protection, and it was, you know, simply so that a person could look up, are they registered, and are they registered at their correct address? That's the information that is you are able to determine.
Madam Chair and Mr. Secretary, that's not the part of the amendment I'm asking about. It says that on page 2, line 16, sub 5 of the amendment, it says that individuals requesting the status of an absentee ballot, not their registration status,
okay,
must provide particular information, and then if it's matches, then the web will inform the individual whether the voter's absentee ballot has been received. Who is that information available to? If I happen to know your name, your address, and your date of birth, and I get it all right, can I go online and determine whether or not you've received an absentee ballot?
Madam Chair, Frazier. Senator Rust, this information is private data under the current statute, and counties have told us that if somebody called in and gave this amount of detail, their name, their address, and their date of birth, that they would feel comfortable that they were talking to the actual person, because private data is available to the actual
this
person.
This is going to be online, Ms. Fraser, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest. So it's applying basically the same standard that's currently used before releasing the information that for the online module. So the answer is yes. If you had somebody's name, exact address, and date of birth, you would be able to find out whether or not they had, and the language as it was introduced in here is limited so that it's just finding out whether or not their absentee ballot has been received.
So it's not.
Ms. Fraser, so just to clarify, received, is that, and that's different from whether their ballot was accepted?
Madam Chair, yes, it is different than accepted.
I'm just thinking back to I needed to vote by absentee ballot this past year, and later I contacted a campaign to see if my absentee ballot had been received or not, and they got back to me and confirmed that it had been received, probably because they knew my name, address, and date of birth, which I didn't give to them, but
public information.
It's public information. So
it's not public information.
It is in the green book.
Public.
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah. I'm not sure if that adds or more confusion or not, but I guess what Senator Rest is also getting at, or what that led me to think, is could the campaign's contact be able to tell whose absentee ballot has been received by the county under this language? Could campaigns contact the Secretary of State's office to determine whose ballot has been received or not?
Madam Chair, if a campaign used the website and entered that information, they would be able to find out whether or not the ballot had been received.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, so in what way is that information protected? Or it's not now protected. It's just more cumbersome to obtain it. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, it is private data, and so counties do try to ensure that they're talking to the person by asking them enough questions before giving out the information. So,
I understand, Madam Chair, I understand that. So when we take the call to the county auditor's office out of the line of inquiry, and we just have going to the website, the information is no longer protected, and people get birthdays, addresses, and names off of databases that are developed by at least two major political parties in this state. The DFL one is called the VAN. It has all this information on there. They can go right to the Secretary of State's website here and be able to tell whether an absentee ballot had been received by that individual. So doesn't that remove the protection?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, it's exactly the same. If the political parties wanted to misrepresent themselves, they could call the county, call Hennepin County, provide the information, receive the information. They can go on a website, provide the information, and receive the information. They can misrepresent themselves equally easily either way.
But Madam Chair, I would suggest that it's far more cumbersome to have to have a phone call. I don't object to being able to do this, but to maintain that it's private data seems to me to be disingenuous. It doesn't become private data. anybody can go and get it, and you're not going to know. I mean, who's going to find out that I went and tried to find his information? Because nobody's going to spend the money to trace that back to me as an individual.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Senator Russ, since so much of this data is public data, it seems odd to me that this is considered private data. I don't think it should be.
Yeah,
and I don't know that anyone, what kind of mischief could someone get into by checking to see if your absentee ballot had been received? Does that rise to a level of needing to be protected somehow?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, exactly. I mean, I agree with you, but if somehow this information is private data, then and we're bypassing that in a sense here, then the Judiciary Committee is going to want to look at this bill if we are substantially changing the use to which this data can be exploited. And the example that comes to mind that, from a conference that I was at a couple of years ago, in one state, this information is not private at all. It's not. Anybody can go online and see who has voted, whether it's by absentee or early voting in those states that have that at a voting center. And at that point, when they discover that someone has already voted, campaigns do it, and they stop sending campaign literature to that individual because that individual has already voted. That would be a prime use of this information by campaigns if that information is available. Not obviously how they voted, but that they voted. And the individuals in this state were extremely pleased by that, actually, because it meant they stopped getting all this junk mail on campaigns. And so they would vote as early as possible. So to stop getting the campaign materials. But if we have a different classification of the information, I think we need to make it clear somewhere that we're changing that here, which would, and private data is data that cannot be released unless the individual on whom the data is kept, as I understand it, says it's okay, as opposed to data which cannot be released even if the individual would be willing. And then there's public data.
Ms. Frazier.
Madam Chair, the reason that absentee data is private and the names of the people who have applied for absentee ballots as private data is because it used to be that the data was public and that county auditors would get calls every day from candidates saying, okay, who did you send absentee ballots to today? Because tomorrow night when they get their ballot, I want to call them while they have it in their hand and ask them to vote for me. And that seemed inappropriate. And so the data was classified as private data until after the election. To Senator Rest's point, one of the suggestions that we've made to Senator Sieben for her absentee balloting bill is to make data private until an absentee ballot has been accepted, at which point it would be public that the ballot had been voted and that could be released. But this...
Well, Senator Sieben and Senator Pappas, I think you need to have that here, too. Otherwise, I think you're confusing things, and I don't know what the language was, but I would suggest that the status of that information has to be changed and has to be changed in this bill as well as in the one that Senator Sieben's carrying.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, if you're going to do that, you might also want to change the online checking so that you can check to see whether or not the ballot has been accepted, not whether it's been received, because even if it's been received, it could be rejected.
Actually, Madam Chair, I think that would be good information for a voter to have, because if they determine that their absentee ballot was not accepted, they might decide they can vote in person or do early voting or do something else. So that to make sure their vote is counted.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, in the end lines of the of sub five there, it says that if the system tells the person that the ballot has
accepted or rejected,
can't be confirmed.
Right.
Yeah, cannot be confirmed, that the individual then would call the county auditor's office and find out, you know, why it had not been accepted, like they hadn't signed it, or we hear often of the county auditor's office calling the voter that, you know, we got your ballot, but, you know, you didn't sign it, so we got your registration form, or you didn't sign it, so we can send it back to you, or you can come in, or we'll write you a letter about it. And so that's already available to them, and that couldn't be done online. I mean, you couldn't correct it online. You have to correct it by having the actual document in front of you, I think. I'm just cautious about changing the status of the data, assuming the change in the status of the data when it's not made explicit in your bill. And maybe Mr. Bodern can make some suggestion about how to say that it is available. You know, it is public data.
Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, I think I'm not quite clear on exactly what it is you would like to change the status of the data to clarify that it is indeed private data, or?
No, I think it, Madam Chair, Mr. Bodern, has to be the other way around. I mean, it has to be accessible, because there's no way on an online that you can make that information secure to the individual to whom it applies. So the only way it could work would be if you made it public. On an online basis, it would seem to me. I mean, you know, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I don't see how that works.
Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, I think if you would describe the absentee ballot information that's available on the web as public data, it would seem to me that then, since that's tracking all of the absentee ballot information submitted within the state, then you'd need to make that change to absentee ballot information generally as well. That might require an amendment to the underlying law.
I don't know how to do that, but I do think it's a really important issue about who can get there, and I don't see a way on the website that you could limit it to the individual about whom the information is being kept. I just think that's not possible.
Senator Pappas and Senator Rest, why don't we take the testimony from the students and then we
come
can
back to it.
Think this over as we're listening to their testimony. So it looks like the next person to testify is Holly Davis. She's here. Please do. Welcome both to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Holly Davis.
I'm Becky Bow.
Good afternoon. I am the Director of Research and Policy for the Minnesota State University Student Association. MSUSA represents students at the 7 state universities, and we work to engage students in the decision-making process, from local and campus decision-making all the way to the federal government, including actually at the state capitol. We have about a dozen students from Bemidji State here today talking to their legislators. But one way we do this is through civic engagement. This year, I coordinated our largest and most successful campaign yet, working with leaders from each campus to register, educate, and get students out to vote. Becky Bow is with me today, who is one of the leaders at Bemidji State University, and she'll be discussing how the changes in SF-661 will positively impact students.
Hello. As Holly said, my name is Becky Bow, and I am a student at Bemidji State University and co-president of our Student Senate. This fall, I was active in our Get Out the Vote efforts, and I am excited to see the changes in the Senate File 661 that will help address some of the challenges we faced during this last election season. First, Residential housing lists have been extremely helpful for students living in the dorms. Students often have a hard time producing the sort of documents they need to prove their residence, and Election Day registration is easier when students can show their student ID and be matched to a list of addresses that the school provided. When I was giving students rides to the polls on Election Day this year, many students had questions about how to register to vote if they weren't already pre-registered. Some students had a utility bill in their name, and others had students that were able to vouch for them. But unfortunately, there were students, though eligible to vote, who were not able to vote because they did not have the necessary documents to prove where they lived. It was disappointing to see students excited about voting turned away, and I wondered how many of them would be back next election season, or how many would be turned off from voting altogether. Expanding the residential housing list will help ensure that eligible voters will be able to cast their ballot. Students also support the provisions to allow online voter registration and a way to check online if an individual is registered to vote. Students are accustomed to doing any number of things online, from paying their tuition bills, registering for classes, buying textbooks, and communicating with professors, friends, and family. In an increasing digital world, it seems only appropriate that these functions are available for voter registration. During the course of our voter registration drive, we heard from a number of students not sure if they were registered to vote at their current address. The best solution we could give them was to go ahead and register again, just to be sure. While this probably caused more administrative work, if they were in fact already registered, it was the best solution that we could provide for them. In the future, it would be great to have a resource for us to check for ourselves and help our peers make sure that they are registered early or prepared to register on Election Day. Thank you very much and for your attention to these issues.
Thank you both for testifying. I think that the real issue here is, speaking for myself, I agree with what you both just said in the aspects of the bill that you testified to. The amendment, however, which I don't know if you received a copy of it, but the amendment seems to expand that. So also online, you would be able to check the status of whether your absentee ballot was accepted or not. And I think that both Senator Rest and I do have some concerns about the about that application of this amendment. Senator Pappas, is there anything you'd like to add?
Madam Chair, only that we should be consistent between the chairwoman's bill and this bill as to how we treat this data. I mean, I think it's kind of unrealistic to expect it to be private data. I think the only way you can do that is have some kind of a password-protected system, which makes it a lot more costly and complicated. And since it's already available for $46 on a disk, it doesn't make sense to me to make it private data, to continue to have it be private data.
Mm-hmm. Senator Rest?
Sure, I agree with that, but I think we would need to specify that somewhere, and I don't see how that's easily done here. So, Senator Pappas, I'm going to move to delete those two sections that deal with the online information. About the...
From the amendment or the bill?
From the amendment.
Madam Chair, do you want to...
And set them with the intent of setting them aside until we can get some really good language and maybe put it in Senator Stevens' bill or maybe return it to your bill later, but that deals with how that data is to be regarded by members of the public. And I don't think it's harmed. I think the part of it's just the voter registration being online, and as I understand it, which is section deleting the one section six and inserting your new section six, but it's section seven and section eight of the amendment deal specifically with absentee ballot issues, and I guess I'd feel more comfortable of not doing away with them, but setting them aside until we get some language that really describes if we indeed are changing the status of the data or not.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it would be good to think about that a little bit more, and I'm just recalling that Ms. Fraser mentioned the problem with campaigns calling and finding out when the absentee ballot is received. So, you know, it might be that we have to do a hybrid, that it's private data until it's accepted, and then public data. Then people can check.
So I'm going to make that motion, if that's okay. Madam Chair?
Senator Rest.
Then on the A1 amendment previously adopted, I would move that we strike sections 7 and 8.
Senator Rest moves to delete sections 7 and 8 of the previously adopted A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
The motion is adopted. To the overall bill, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, unless there's anyone else that wants to testify, I would just move that Senate File 661, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee.
Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? On Senator Pappas's motion, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 660. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. Senate File 660 is a bill that would help facilitate registration and updated records in that every time you get a driver's license or ID card, you would be automatically registered unless you reject that. And along with that, it would also have some, for the first time, we'd be doing a lot of verification of eligibility from death records, from court records, from everywhere else. And so I think this is one, tightens up on potential of wrong people being registered, and also makes it easier for more people to be registered. And among other things, this bill should result in some fairly significant savings to counties who are pretty hard pressed these days in two ways. One of which is it does not require them to manually enter all this data because the people would be automatically registered and their registrations would be updated when they move. And it would also reduce the number of Election Day registrations, meaning they wouldn't have to have as many election judges there to handle Election Day registration. So I think this is a bill that would not only improve our elections process, make it easier for more people to vote, make sure the wrong people are not voting, and save money for the counties. And with that, Beth Fraser from Secretary of State's office is going to go through the bill section by section. But we do have an A1 amendment.
Senator Marty, is this a technical amendment?
It is. There's a technical change in the technical amendment. However, on line 2, it should read, instead of after and, it should read after address, comma, insert and, comma, if available. And with that change incorporated, I'll move the A1 amendment.
Senator Marty moves the A1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Beth Fraser, the Secretary of State's office. Section 1 of this bill gives our office authorization to use information from the Social Security Death Index. Right now, we get information about people who have died from the Minnesota Department of Health, but if somebody dies out of state, we don't get notice of that, so this would allow us to identify people who are registered to vote who have since passed away out of state. Section 2 has to do with data that we should be getting from the courts related to people who change their names using the court process. And right now, these individuals are sent information telling them that they have to re-register to vote. Instead, this section would automatically re-register them under their new legal name. Sections 3, 4, and 5 are somewhat technical amendments to current sections of law that give us information from the court administrator, allowing us to also get, if available, the individual's driver's license, state identification number, and the last four digits of their Social Security number. Right now, the courts have said that for many individuals, they do have that data, but without either legislation or a court order, they don't feel that they can give it to us. So that would give them the ability to pass this data on. Section 6 would have us work with the Department of Corrections. There are people who are under the jurisdiction of the Department of Corrections when they're serving their felony sentence. And we are currently not getting information on when those people have finished serving their felony sentence. So this would, on an event basis, give us information that this individual has finished serving their sentence. Section 7 is also related to data from the Department of Corrections. And it would allow us, on a periodic basis, at least monthly, to run the whole voter registration database against data that the Department of Corrections has about who is serving felony sentences under their jurisdiction, and that would allow us to flag individuals whose registration should be challenged, and if we have anyone whose registration it appears should no longer be challenged because they finished their sentence, that would allow us to remove the challenge. Section 8 would give us specific authorization to obtain and to use information from the Department of Public Safety based upon citizenship. Right now, they have information about status check, and so people who are here on temporary visas. And we have obtained that information in the past, but we would like specific authority to do so and authority for us and the counties to use that information to flag individuals who are apparently not citizens who are registered to vote. The next section of the bill, Section 9, has to do with, as Senator Marty described, the automatic registration of individuals when they get a driver's license, instruction permit, or identification card, unless they opted out. Their data would be sent to our office. We would then check a variety of databases to see whether the data indicates that they are not eligible to vote. So we would check on their felony status with the courts to see if their voting rights have been revoked. It would require the Department of Public Safety to add to the main part of the driver's license a question that folks would answer under penalty of perjury: are you a citizen, yes or no? And we would also use that to weed out people who indicate that they are not citizens. As long as data does not indicate that they are ineligible to vote, we would register them. The counties would activate their records, and voters would be sent a notice letting them know that they were now registered to vote and that if they didn't want to be, they should contact the county auditor. Section 10 is the effective date section, and it was changed in the author's amendment so that three of the sections, sections 2, 6, and 7, are each effective upon certification that these new systems have been tested and worked. And sections 3, 4, and 5 are effective the day following final enactment. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Could you address why in Section 1 the Secretary of State may determine if any of the persons listed on the Social Security Death Index are registered to vote? Is that because it's may because you only get that information at certain times? I'm wondering why it's may and not will.
Madam Chair, it could be must or shall, if you would prefer.
You're fairly certain you'll get that information whenever you need it.
Madam Chair, there is a cost to obtaining this data, and we believe that we could use the Help America Vote Act funds to do so. I guess if down the road we ran out of money, May would allow us not to do so. But it is our intent to do so. So must would suffice as well.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to strike the word may on line 13 and insert must.
Not must, shall.
Shall. Senator Marty moves that amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Motion is adopted. Mr. Secretary, did you want to testify on this bill?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to underline the many advantages that we see to the local election officials and to the counties, particularly on a budgetary matter, of this approach. We're reaching the point where between 90 and 95% of our citizens are registered. That's also the case in Iowa, Michigan, similar states. In a big election year like the last one, the last two, where we have about 600,000 people registering on election day, about half are just changing addresses, and so we have proposals this year to do that automatically. The other half are registering, and they've probably been through the system of getting a driver's license or an ID. And so for a county like Hennepin, just on address changes alone, the savings may be $1 million every 2 years. So if you could double those savings and reduce the errors, and as Ms. Frazier described, our ability to take this information from Department of Public Safety and then to use the corrections database, the Social Security, all those different databases gives us a much greater accuracy and a much deeper method to make sure we have clean lists with no one on the list that shouldn't be on, but also making sure that the information is absolutely current if they've changed a name or if somebody has died. This gives us a great deal more accuracy in our systems. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gerlach?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty and Secretary Ritchie, the bill, all the components of the bill about updating the lists, I think those are good things. I think that if someone's made the affirmative action to register to vote, and these various life changes, be they moves, be they name changes, felony convictions, whatever they are, you know, in the age of computers, to have these things happen and be updated, I think, is a good thing. All of those take place in the context of a voter or a person, a citizen, a resident, who is eligible to vote, who had taken the affirmative action to register to vote. Section 9, however, in the bill is the automatic registration of voters. And I think that, members, that this is a significant departure from the rest of the bill. Most of this bill is about updating existing records, and Section 9 is very, very problematic for me for a number of reasons, and I would like for us to zero in on that and discuss that. And then I'm going to suggest that maybe we separate that out of this bill, handle it separately, either as another bill or however you want to do it, because I think it would be a shame to lose the other good stuff for what I believe would be a very controversial piece and have a very rocky road going forward and probably not get signed into law unless you maybe know something I don't. So with that, I guess, in fact, why don't we do it this way, Madam Chair? Why don't I just make the motion and then I can speak to the motion and then we can discuss it so that we have it on the table. Madam Chair, I'd like to move that we delete Section 9 from this bill. And I believe that just simply covers the automatic registration section, and we'll leave everything else intact. If that's correct, then that would be my motion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gerlach.
You would need also to delete the effective date of Section 9 in lines 534 and 39.
Does everyone understand Senator Gerlach's amendment? Mr. Bodden?
Madam Chair, you'd also need to amend part of the A1 amendment to delete page 1, lines 10 through 13.
So Senator Gerlach moves to delete Section 9 of the bill and also the on lines 5 point, what are the lines?
1.10.
5.34. And 5.35.
And sub 2.
Subdivision 2. Also delete those references and then additionally delete the references on the A1 amendment lines 1.10 to 1.13. Would you like to?
That's my motion. Then I'd like to speak to that.
Okay. please go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think this is important for us as a committee to talk about this, and I think that, again, as I said, all of the pieces of this bill are about updating an action that was already taken, a conscious affirmative action by a resident to say, I want to vote. That's why we have voter registration. It should be that affirmative action. There's a basic principle that we really should have throughout government, and that is people ought to know what they're doing, not just in government, but in any transactions that we have in society. People should have informed knowledge about what they're doing. And we can say that, well, it's an opt-out. You know, there's printing on here that says if you don't want to register, then you check this off. Well, that's the, you know, we debate a lot of issues around here about whether there should be opt-ins or opt-outs. And we know that whether something is an opt-in or opt-out has significant influence over the outcome. We had about 6 years ago, we had a lot of telemarketing bills that were very pervasive through the legislature. And we had a lot of discussion about whether you should be able to opt in or opt out of a do not call list. And because I had very different, you know, reasons. And I would expect, I'm going to guess that Senator Marty held a position that one would have to, you assume that you're not on a call list unless you, you know, opt in, that you're making an affirmative action. I'm guessing that was probably your position. Maybe I'm wrong. Because I don't know. I'm just guessing. It was certainly the position of a lot of people that philosophically someone ought to, should make some of these affirmative actions. Unless I have that particular example backwards. But clearly, we know that there have been issues regarding phone bills or other utility bills where charges are automatically put on unless you opt out of a particular something. And we know that that's a nefarious practice because people don't look at that. They don't see that. They just look at the bottom line and pay their bill. And some companies prey upon that, and they use that strategy to elicit a certain outcome, in that case, to reap more profits. This idea of putting something in place where people are not really prepared for, are not making an affirmative, they're not going there to register to vote, they're going there to get their driver's license. And it just violates the basic principle of people knowing what they're doing and making affirmative action to register to vote. That's the first point, and I guess we could discuss, and I have two other issues as well. But, Senator Marty, maybe you can give me your take on this and whether it ought to be a knowledgeable, fully informed affirmative action or not.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, first of all, I prefer to say with the do not call that I favored people having to opt out of getting their phone line protected from solicitations. So I thought you should... My phone line should be private from that unless I opt out of that. So that's what I favor. And with this, when you register to vote, you are also men at age 18 are automatically registered for Selective Service. They can't even opt out of that. I think that this is something like Selective Service. It's a part of our obligation, our rights, our duties as a citizen. This gives us the right to be registered. You don't vote automatically. You're only registered. And I think, again, to make the entire process simpler, to save the money from the counties, to avoid the last-minute rush, to avoid everything else, I think the assumption should be that in this democracy, people are voting. They're going to vote. And they want to be registered. They have to take an affirmative step to vote. But I just think that this is reasonable to make it that when you go in and change your driver's license, that we update the records, and that if you're not registered, we register you.
Okay.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I guess I don't take such a serious look at this. It seems to me this is a convenience for the citizen. They're providing the same information on a voter registration card that they are in a driver's license, and a reason to opt out might be if they're not legally eligible to vote. That would be a reason to opt out. Otherwise, as Senator Marty said, if they really chose not to vote, they could always not vote, even though they weren't registered. But this just seems to me to be just kind of convenient.
Senator Gerlach?
The other day we were talking about a...
Like if you're not 18.
It was mentioned, I think it was Senator Pappas, about odd cases where it was mentioned about Jehovah's Witnesses, a particular religious denomination that believes in the opposite of what many of us believe in civic participation. They have the opposite view. Is it possible, Senator Marty, that a lot of people who are Jehovah's Witnesses that would show up, get a driver's license, and unbeknownst to them, suddenly have violated their religious beliefs?
Senator Marty, I believe there's...
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, I don't want to speak for somebody else's religious beliefs, but I thought they had a prohibition on voting, not registering to vote. And again, they are going to be informed that this is an option they can opt out of. But I guess I think that in terms of the vast majority of the population does want to register to vote. They do register to vote. Matter of fact, that's one of the reasons we have such long lines on Election Day. I think if we make this thing automatic, we're going to have it. It's facilitating your participation in the electoral process. If you don't want to vote, you don't have to vote. But I think, as Senator Pappas said, this is just kind of a automatic thing that's convenient for not only for the voter, but also convenient for the counties and saving money for the taxpayers.
Well, Madam Chair, then I guess I'll take that as a yes, that there could be some people who don't. I mean, I agree with you that a vast majority of people would be fine, but people who don't want to also have rights. And we cannot set up a governmental system whereby it's, automatically things are happening.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, this is not the case in things like selective service, jury duty, many other things, but certainly in Minnesota and in other Midwestern states, somewhere around 95% of the people get registered. Here we jam them all into the last week before the election or Election Day. It's a nightmare. And so this is really not about Jehovah's Witnesses. This is not about, adding charges to people, although it does cost counties more, the current system. And this would lift a lot of cost off of counties for sure. So there are financial implications. But some states, like North Dakota, they don't have voter registration. They've called voter registration a barrier to voting, and they've gotten rid of it. And so in our state, what we're trying to do here is stop the crush of registration before and on registration day and do it automatically, electronically, accurately, month after month, year after year, as people register. We know that 95% of the adults are going to register, so perhaps there'll be 5% opt out. I don't know who the 5% will be, but this certainly isn't about violating people's religious rights. This is about lowering the cost to counties and getting the accuracy up on our list.
Madam Chair, Mr. Secretary, I think that accuracy piece is very important, too, for local election administrators. But Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, one thing that I ran into when I was door knocking this fall, I have a lot of downtown apartment buildings that I spend a lot of time in, and I find that people are very mobile there. They move a lot. And a lot of times they don't realize that when you move, you have to re-register. Now, it wouldn't help with people who hadn't changed their driver's license, but it would be very much a convenience for them and raise their awareness if they would be re-registered when they change their driver's license, because they're part of that crush at the end. You know, we have to then tell them how to register. If it's before the deadline, we can register them. But if it's after the deadline, we just have to tell them how to register on Election Day.
Madam Chair?
Madam Chair,
Senator Pappas, that's right. And every person, of course, gets a postcard that says, if you don't want to be registered, you don't have to be. And if this address is somehow not correct, can you correct it or whatever? So there's always a second system on this for anybody who would, choose to somehow otherwise. And, again, it's about 5%. We know it's about 5%.
Mr. Secretary, you said that. Did you just say they get a postcard? Because I think it also says on here that the form, they could check a box on the form saying they didn't want to register.
Yes, absolutely. Those who were registered, Madam Chair, those who were registered also have a further chance with a postcard. So, yes, you check a box, you opt out. It's kind of normal. But you also have then a second time. Maybe you had a change of heart and decided after you were registered that you didn't want to be for whatever reason. There is a second
safeguard.
Yeah, it's a fallback kind of a safety net system for everybody.
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, thank you. I find it kind of ironic because I don't support voter ID for when you go to vote, and yet we're almost making that part of the process. So it to me it almost seems harder to The one reason I don't support it is a lot of the discussions that we've had at this committee, actually, but it almost makes it a tough position not to defend when we're saying that, well, cripes, we allow you to register when you sign up for your license and all that kind of stuff. So I'm kind of struggling with that. Any input I would appreciate.
Mr. Secretary.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Central Scene. They're not really related except that the voter registration is a completely separate matter for voting. So, you know, I think it's really important to separate these out. Voter registration. In Minnesota, we used to have a system like they have today in North Dakota where you built a voter system, except we had registration where there were students and soldiers. People who lived near student and soldiers had very difficult time getting registered and were basically often discriminated in voting. There was a big debate in 1972. Actually, the governor was up in North Dakota hunting, and in the meeting with legislators, he said, let's get rid of the voter registration. It's an attempt to discriminate, to keep people from voting. The legislator said, no, wait a minute. We like voter registration lists because that gives us a way to contact voters and to mail and all that kind of thing. And so the compromise was require voter registration statewide, allow for same-day registration. That was 1972-73. That's where our system comes from. But, of course, as a society, we've become more mobile. We've grown. We have 75,000 young people who come of age each year. We have a tremendous number of people, and 600,000 people roughly register on Election Day, and we have a crush of people who register right before Election Day. So you've got 600, 700, maybe 800,000 people all trying to go through a narrow system, writing usually with some fairly poor handwriting. You have people trying to read what they wrote. All of those things, when we have, in fact, people standing in line, getting driver's licenses and getting IDs, putting information down, that's being data entered. It becomes electronic. And then you can check for felons, check for citizens. You can do all kinds of things. So the convenience of doing this for a local elected official cannot be overstated. The cost savings will be tremendous, but the accuracy that we will, as citizens and those of us who are politicians who use the list for our various campaigning purposes, the accuracy of the list that's possible is quite important. Right now, the list of citizens registered right before an election is about one-third wrong because 600,000 people plus more register on Election Day, either change their address or register. So we know this kind of approach will not only save a tremendous amount of money, but it'll also give us a voter registration list that is accurate each month, month after month, and we can electronically check it for all the eligibility questions so we can further enhance its reliability. So it has all of those advantages because month after month, people go in and either update their driver's license or get a driver's license. So it's not the crush on Election Day or the weeks before trying to put all those people through a little tiny funnel. Frankly, our election administrators, this year is unusual. We had two recounts and everything else. But they are exhausted after a big election, and they face a huge job, which is called data entry of Election Day registrations. In many small rural counties, the county auditor does the typing. You know, we have a system that's a little bit crazy for in terms of resources. When we can use the work of Department of Public Safety and the motor vehicles already doing the data entry to create a system, electronic system that we can use, that seems to us to be a much smarter kind of Minnesota way to do this very big job, but very important job.
Senator Gerlach.
Senator Rath.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I'd like to ask a question about 515 through 525 on page 5. There is a proposal coming forward that will permit, or we permit right now, people to register to vote when they're 17 if they're going to be 18 before Election Day. And 2 points. There is a proposal coming forward that would allow those same individuals to vote in a primary election to select the candidates on which, whom they make a decision on the general election day. But I wonder, is the implication here
with lines 520 on, that 16-year-olds or 15-year-olds who go to get a driver's license, will they be put on an automatic waiting list as registered voters? That will be like a suspense list. And then when they're 18, they'll be moved over onto the voter registration list. Because I see that it involves an instruction permit as well as a driver's license. So are we going, will this apply then to 15-year-olds, and then a suspense list will be created that then will be updated, and those folks will be automatically registered when they turn 18. And then I have that separate issue about whether you can vote in a primary if you're going to be 18 by election day. But is that how that would work?
Ms. Frazier?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Rest. Yes, there would be a pending list of individuals who were not yet eligible because under current law they're not yet 18.
Would Ms. Frazier, would that pending list stay within the Secretary of State's office or be delivered to the county auditors with the other data?
Madam Chair, the data would stay with the Secretary of State's office until they turn 18, and then we would check to see if there's some reason that they're not eligible before sending it to the county auditor.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, and Senator Marty or Ms. Frazier, Secretary, when you apply for an instruction permit, and I don't have a teenager, so I don't know how that works, but I know you apply for instruction permit, you have to, there's certain restrictions,
test.
And then somewhere along the line, I don't know what age it is, are you automatically sent a true driver's license, or do you have to reapply for it?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, there are two separate things, and you have to take a test as a driving test. And the learner's permit is actually for many different ages use that particular, but it's most normally for younger people. But when you get a driver's license, you have to apply, pass the test, have proof of your training and that kind of thing. So there's nothing automatic that happens. More common is that young people are just getting their identification card. You know, there are a lot of young people not following that former path of a driver's license.
Madam Chair, I'm a little bit uncomfortable about 15-year-olds being put on a voter registration list. And I can understand that instruction permit could apply to somebody who's 35, for that matter, I guess. But
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, they're
that
not.
A lot,
they're
that's
absolutely.
What that would mean, and so that, so we have a list of 15, 16-year-olds sitting around for 2.5, 3 years before they're eligible to vote.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, a couple states have 16 and 17-year-old registration. We're absolutely not proposing that. This list should not be characterized as a registration or a pre-registration list or anything to that sort. When people are on that list, they're just in suspension. They are not on a registration or a pre-registration list. Some states do that, and they have a lot of arguments in favor of it, but we're not making that proposal.
Senator Madam Chair and Mr. Secretary, I understand that because there is a there has been discussion here, I don't know if in your office, but certainly, and I don't remember who brought it up to me, but a proposal that would indeed go to the high schools and ask people to register to vote on a provisional basis and do it when they're juniors in high school, and then when they get to be 18, it just becomes, that is their voter registration when they get to be that when they have to get to 18.
Teachers will register once they turn 18.
How? Ms. Fraser said that the secretary's office would hold that information as a suspense list. Where is the language that would give me comfort that indeed is what's happened from lines 515 to 525?
Madam Chair, Senator Ress, it would be against the law, be a violation of law, to forward any name of someone who wasn't 18. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, individuals aren't added to the voter registration list except by the county auditor. And so until the data is transmitted to the county auditor, it would not be added to the active list of registered voters. So the fact that the language says that we would wait until the person was 18 to check the databases to see if for some reason they were not eligible and only then transmit the data to the county auditor means that they would not show up on any list of registered voters.
Senator Rest.
Okay. I do have a concern that we're absolutely clear about that. Because I think that there's some invitation for exploitation if the security of that, of those names, of those young people are compromised in your system, that's all. But just want to be careful about that.
Senator Rest, would it be, I'm just thinking aloud here, but if you said in on lines 4.24, an individual who is 18 years old properly completes an application. I assume, though, that the result of trying to change that is it would add one more process for the DVS to determine, which I don't think we want to do. But
the 18-year-old, okay, the person who turns 18, Madam Chair, the person who turns 18 has to reapply for their driver's license. That's what you're saying, Mr. Secretary, correct?
No.
No? I don't know the process is what I don't know what you have to do. If there is an official step when your driver's license, I mean, is official step of getting a driver's license with out restrictions other than the ones that older people have occurs at age 18?
Madam Chair, Senator Ress?
No.
Many young people apply for an ID at 16 and 17 and never apply for a driver's license. And so, you know, if the worry is about some compromising of data, a hacker or some sort of, you know, we have hackers from China who occasionally hit the state of Minnesota databases. That's always a worry. But this is not that kind of list. It's really not of any real interest to anybody. It's data that's sitting at Department of Public Safety, or it could be sitting at a high school, high school yearbook. It's really, it's just a way of managing the system so that only 18-year-olds are then evaluated to see if they meet all the other criteria and then forwarded. That's all it is.
Madam Chair,
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson was just sharing something with me, and I said, "Well, I don't have boys, so I don't know how it works." And he was talking about the selective service system, where boys are signed up when they apply for their driver's license, probably at age 16 or age 17, but they aren't officially part of the selective service. They don't get their card until they're 18. So they
would this work the same way?
Well, it sounds like a similar concept. Sure.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been working on my list of other items here.
All right.
Secretary Ritchie, I would contend that of the body of people that go to register to vote, when they take a voter registration card and they fill that out, that with 100% accuracy, I would say that body of people knows exactly what they're doing, that they know that they are affirmatively registering to vote. And all, with all the implications with that, rights, privileges, everything else. Under this proposal, would you say that 100% of people that go to get their driver's license would be fully knowledgeable that they have just registered to vote.
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, I wouldn't agree that everyone who's filled in a voter registration form in this state in the last 2 years have been fully knowledgeable what they're doing, and I also would not agree that absolutely 100% of people coming into a driver's license bureau would know exactly what all the procedures were. But is it 99%? Yes.
Okay, Madam Chair, let me rephrase the question a little bit then. It would be my contention that far more people would knowingly and affirmatively know what they're doing when they register to vote if they're filling out a voter registration card. And I believe that a significant number less would know that they are affirmatively registering to vote under this current proposal. Do you agree or disagree with that assertion?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, I have no idea. We could ask Selective Service if that's been true in their experience or not.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, Selective Service really isn't even really relevant here because we're talking about something that is voluntary. Selective Service is not voluntary. I mean, they're two different, completely different things. We can talk about the mechanics of the holding tank or whatever they do, but as far as the notion or the principle at work here, Selective Service is something completely different. But I realize, I mean, I know you're not quite willing to, I mean, to put out there what I think
Madam
everybody
Chair,
understands.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, conjecture is not really part of what I do in my job.
Okay. As legislators, then, Madam Chair, I think it's up to us to then provide that conjecture. And I think that a reasonable assessment of this is that if people go to register to vote and fill out a voter registration card, that the far, far more of them know what they're doing than we can expect from an opt-out system where people are going to get their driver's license and on the side they're being registered to vote. I think that that's just common sense. I think that we know that's the case.
Madam Chair.
And Senator Pappas will say, then I want to get back to my list.
Madam Chair, when I register voters, I fill out the card because I want to make sure it's legible so the voter will actually get to register. And I'm more familiar with the card than a voter is. So I don't hand it to the voter. Mostly they prefer. I fill out the card, and then they read the oath at the bottom, and then they sign it, and I tell them where to sign and to date it. That I don't know that that is any more of an informed decision than it is to be in applying for your driver's license and reading the oath and signing at that stage of the game. You know, it seems to me they're both the same. The goal here is getting the voter registered and having it legible so that the authorities can, you know, incorporate them as a registered voter. It doesn't seem to me that there's any difference here.
Sure. Madam Chair, and to Senator Pappas, I'll tell you that there's a significant difference. It doesn't matter whose pen was to paper. You had a conversation with them, so you explained to them about voter registration. They authorized you to fill it out for them on the clipboard or whatever it is you're doing. So that is the process of an informed and affirmative decision. They knew exactly what they were doing. It wasn't you weren't going door to door and getting them driver's licenses or whatever it was, or signing a parks petition, and then by the way, there's another box here if you don't opt out. You also are taking whatever other actions. I mean, they're very different. Madam Chair, if I could ask a question, I understand that driver's license data cannot be sold. And a number of years ago, we changed that law, and a lot of commercial interests would buy driver's license data, and that we have put a stop to that, and that we cannot currently, citizens or businesses cannot currently buy those lists from the state. Am I correct in that? Maybe Mr. Bonner knows. Am I correct in that we cannot buy driver's license data?
Mr. Bonner.
Madam Chair, I think I'd have to defer to the committee there. That's outside my area.
Oh, okay. But maybe Senator Marty knows that.
Madam Chair, Marty. Senator Gerlach, I believe you cannot buy them for commercial purposes.
Okay.
For solicitation purposes, you can buy them for insurance companies, buy them for their driving records and so on. There are some purposes you can.
Some purposes you can. Okay.
Senator Gerlach.
Well, I guess my point, Madam Chair, was that voter data can be bought quite easily and very inexpensively through the Secretary of State's office. Mm. We all do that.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, only for political purposes, not for commercial purposes. It's the same as driver's license data. It's for limited purposes only.
Well, Madam Chair,
it's
for limited purposes, but it's certainly different purposes than driver's license data. It's for political purposes. So you can't you cannot buy driver's license data for political purposes, but if you go and under this plan that we have before us today, you go ahead and apply for your driver's license, and I believe that a number of people certainly will not opt out. They will unknowingly have registered to vote. That data then will be able to be purchased for political reasons and under a whole different system.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, you're forgetting that there is a second postcard that is sent out to people which says, are you sure you want to be registered? Is this your address? Is this what you want to do? So,
Mr. Secretary, would that postcard also catch if someone would register or apply for a driver's license at a different address than where they register to vote? I assume that
sure, it would be the check, Madam Chair.
Would
yes,
also make sure that
sure
happens. Senator Gerlach.
Madam Chair, I'm going to talk about students for a moment. I understand that students, because we were just talking about this, that students, when they go to college, they can maintain their home record, so to speak, back home. So they go from a town and they go down to a college, and they may know somebody for whatever reason, they want to vote absentee back home. But while they're at college, if they go get their driver's license renewed or whatever it is or whatever they're doing and get that, then, correct me if I'm wrong here, but then the system will move their voting registration to their college address now, because that's where they may have put as their where they're currently living from their driver's license. What am I missing there?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Secretary.
If they chose to get a new driver's license in the town of where they went to college, which is very rare, but if they did do that, they would get a postcard that said, did you intend to re-register for the purposes of voting to your new address or not?
Okay, well, Madam Chair, that's not the scenario I'm talking about. Someone who moves, they get their driver's license renewed with their college address,
mm-hmm.
but yet they want to continue, they want to vote in the next election back home.
Correct.
But now, okay, they're going to get some card in the mail, which possibly can be overlooked. Suddenly now, they didn't take the affirmative action to change their voter registration, yet now the system moved them to their college address. Am I wrong on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, it is occasionally true that a student will get a new driver's license in their college town. It's rare, but it does happen. And they would get a card. They might overlook it, but, of course, they could overlook anything. But, of course, in Minnesota's system with Election Day registration, they would be able to vote wherever they chose to vote when they decided to vote, which could be absentee at home. So each of the steps that you described is rare, but there's always in the Minnesota system a fallback for that situation. We can put all kinds of barriers to voting in our system, but we do always have a certain amount of fallback because we have same-day registration, we have the follow-up postcard, we have all of these things in place.
Senator Gerlach?
Well, Senator Ross, to this, if you're...
Well, I was just curious about the postcard. When somebody registers to vote, they get a single postcard. Now, were you talking about a second postcard?
Madam Chair, Senator Resnick, they would get that postcard.
That postcard. And on that postcard, there are instructions that say if you currently, it just says you've been registered to vote. Is there any statement on the postcard currently that says if this is a mistake, please call and get your name taken off?
Madam Chair, Senator Ress, no, there isn't, but we would revise the postcard if the proposal went forward.
Okay, so where in here is there that statement that there would be a revised postcard giving someone the opportunity to refuse the registration?
Ms. Frazier?
Madam Chair, Senator Ress, it's Subdivision 4 that requires the notice. I don't believe that the language of the postcard is listed anywhere in statute, but we would make the necessary changes to the postcard.
Ms. Frazier, I see that the county auditor is mailing that postcard, it looks like.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And that's what they currently do now.
Yes, Madam Chair. They queue it in the statewide voter registration system. They're sent out centrally, but it's paid for by the county.
Senator Rest.
So, Madam Chair, I don't know that we should dictate the language of the postcard, but I think we should indicate that the postcard will provide an opportunity, because it's automatic now, will provide an opportunity for a voter to contact the county auditor and decline. Senator Marty, what
Madam
do you think
Chair,
about that?
Senator Rest, I think that's a good idea, and it looks like Senate Council is beginning to draft something.
And I would that be under something like in the same section of sub 4?
On
526,
like
527, to add some language there to say that upon receipt of the
I'm sorry,
the notice of registration.
I think we're still on my amendment.
I know. I'm just, it can be, I see.
Just for information, Mr.
Yes,
Bodner.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Mr.
I'll
Bodner,
come back to it later. But I do
201.
Think that's important to do after we vote on your amendment. I'm sorry, Senator Long.
Mr. Bodden, under Section 201.121, Subdivision 2, is there any language requiring
Division
what
two?
The postcard says?
No. Madam Chair, it's a
the
fairly short
says.
Subdivision and just requires the auditor to mail a notice indicating the registration information to each registered voter, and then provides for what to do in the event that it's returned as non-deliverable.
We are still on the Gerlach
My
motion.
Is inappropriate right now.
Senator Gerlach, would you like to say
yep.
anything before we vote on your motion?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. Thank you. Senator Marty, granted the legislature will certainly propose bills. The governor can do what he wants, but is there any, have you had any discussions with the governor's office on where they stand on this bill, and specifically sections 1 through 8, and also, of course, section 9?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, no, we haven't. The bill has just been introduced recently.
Okay. Madam
again,
Chair.
Again, I think that this is a good package that makes it easier on the voter, easier on the state to make sure they're accurate, and easier on the counties and financially saving taxpayers a lot of money.
Okay.
Senator Gerlach.
Madam Chair, I'll conclude then on my questions about my amendment to take out Section 9. The reason I think it's important to take out Section 9 is because Sections 1 through 8, I think, make sense. And I think that it would be foolish for us to go forward with something of great controversy that, you know, and again, it's not just me. I think it's much broader controversy, and that a bill that could easily meet with the governor's veto, and then you lose the other parts. I think that it's important, committee members, to let's take something that's good here. Let's keep sections 1 through 8, and let's let that bill move along, and let's get some good enhanced voter registration lists with the Secretary of State's office. I think that's all good. I think we all agree on that. Section 9 is controversial, and I would just say in summary, I think, you know, it's convenience is fine, but it's not a sufficient reason for the government to collect data from citizens. No matter how noble the cause may be, the government is collecting data from citizens to put into a computer database system for a purpose, when clearly the citizens, there's a good number of them, you can debate about how much, but there clearly will be citizens that are not giving their fully informed, knowledgeable, implied, or not even implied, but express consent to the government collecting that information. And I think that that's wrong. And, you know, people have a right to vote, absolutely. But people also, the Constitution also guarantees people the right not to vote. And we are violating that secondary principle when we're going forward in the search of what is, you know, a noble goal. We cannot forget the other side of that right. And so, members, I'm appealing to you to vote for my amendment. Let's take Section 9 out. Let's let the rest of the bill go forward, and so it can be passed. That's my pitch.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I just want to remind him that it doesn't collect any new data that somebody's not already providing. It also does not make anybody vote. Not a single person will mistake the fact that they're registered to vote for the fact that they are somehow believe they're obligated to vote. I don't think there will be a single person who believes that. And I think it's just good common sense. It saves money. It helps make our voter rolls more accurate. And I think we should go ahead and do this common sense thing.
On the Gerlach motion, all in favor of Senator Gerlach's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
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 The motion does not prevail. Senator Rest.
I would like to address my concern in an amendment on lines 526 and 27 to say that the notice of registration, I hope Mr. Bodden will help me here, the notice of registration must include, an opportunity for the voter or for the individual to decline the registration. I'm not sure how to word that, Mr. Bonner.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, you could, on page 5, line 27, after the period, add another sentence to that subdivision that would say, the notice must inform the voter that the voter may contact the county auditor to correct or remove the registration. The notice must provide the contact information for the county auditor.
Madam Chair, that would be my my motion to amend the bill.
Mr. Bonner, could you please repeat that one more time?
On page 5, line 27, after the period, would read, the notice must inform the voter that the voter may contact the county auditor to correct or remove the registration. The notice must provide the contact information for the county auditor, and we may need to pick up other officials there, but I think the county auditor will suffice.
On the motion, all in favor of the Senator Rest amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I would move the bill.
Is there any, it looks like there are two other people who wanted to testify on the bill. Would they still like to do that? Mike Dean?
Please.
Mr. Dean, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. We're a government watchdog organization. You've covered most of the arguments already, so I'm going to keep this extremely brief. Just to let you know that Common Cause supports this bill, mainly because we see that voter registration problems are a huge barrier to voting throughout the country. Even in Minnesota, which has Election Day registration, our current voter registration system has been susceptible to typographical errors that can occur throughout the process. And voter registration errors can disenfranchise some voters, and unfortunately, we did see this in the 2008 election. Throughout Election Day, the media actually reported a whole host of registration problems faced by voters. For example, NPR reported that Rob Steinwall of Bloomington called election officials to verify whether he was registered to vote, was told by officials in weeks leading up to Election Day that he was, plus he had voted with no problems in 2006, but when he went to the polls on Election Day, he discovered he was no longer on the rolls. And this happened to countless of other voters that we heard of. And so we think that this 21st century voter registration system would go a long way in addressing these voter registration system problems. Also will help the county save significant money. So with that, thank you.
Thank you. It also looks, Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I forgot your name.
Mike Dean.
Mr. Dean. In those cases that you just mentioned.
Yes.
Those individuals were able to register that day, so I assume that nobody was denied a right to vote?
Mr. Dean.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, actually that was not the case. I did not mention in my extended testimony, there were actually a few individuals that tried to vote on Election Day, and they went to the polls but did not bring proper identification because they thought they were registered and thus were turned away and were disenfranchised from voting, unfortunately.
Ms. Sapp, is she in the audience? Would you also like to testify on this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Erin Sapp, and I am with the Heartland Democracy Center here to testify today in support of Senate File 660, specifically Section 9. We have just published a report on 21st century voter registration and believe that tapping existing resources of information is a key method that will help us move to an accurate and cost-effective voter registration system. One of the easiest databases to tap is that of driver's license and state ID cards, and would just be the next step from our current voter registration system. First, there's a few benefits to this sort of registration process. First, we'd achieve more complete and clean voter rolls, as we've heard about before. Using the DMV database to populate the rolls would ensure that more eligible voters made it onto the rolls, thereby making the voters' rolls more complete. Additionally, they would be more accurate by helping to track more nimbly name changes and address changes, and would help to ensure that voters aren't wrongly purged off the rolls due to clerical errors, inactivities, or other issues. Second, Minnesota would likely see increased voter participation. We know that voter participation is very highly correlated with voter registration. Third, it would promote a resource-efficient system because registrations can be managed on an ongoing basis rather than in floods prior to an election. Election administrators would have more consistent workloads and demands on their time. Additionally, we'd save millions of dollars each election cycle from non-governmental groups who currently spend a lot of time and volunteer time and lots of money running massive voter registration drives. Fourth, we would reap huge fiscal savings, as has been attested by Mr. Secretary. The cost of implementation after that, we would save lots of money both on the county level and the state level. And finally, and perhaps more important, we would foster greater trust in our government. We'd be eliminating barriers to voting. State government would raise their accountability to voters, thereby fostering confidence and trust in the system that helps ensure that all eligible voters can cast their ballot on Election Day.
Thank you for their testimony. Are there any questions? On the bill, is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate File 660? All those in favor of Senate File 660 as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I should note before I leave that that our system has already been better than lots of other places. When I was in college, I grew up in the Chicago area and registered in Cook County, and 15 years later, well, I remember 2 years later, I switched my registration up here because I was going to be voting up here. And being a college kid trying to do things right, I actually sent a notice to the registrar in Cook County saying to drop my name from the voter rolls. And my parents, 15 years later, 1990, sent me a voter registration card. This card is your voter registration card. I wondered how many times I was voting in Cook County without knowing.
Blagojevich?
Can't say that.
Name. Senator Ress, Senate File 278. Blagojevich. Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Ress, Senate File 278 is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Bill.
Senate File 278 is a bill that I developed that's similar to bills in other states that use an alternative process to selecting a United States senator when a vacancy is declared in that office. And in Minnesota, for all members of the legislature, under certain circumstances, and for all members of Congress, the House of Representatives, when there is a vacancy in those offices, there is no appointment that is done to replace that elected official. Instead, there is a special election called with the various timings and so on that are part of that process. And when I checked into it, I found that there are a number of states that do indeed call for and allow for a special election, again, under certain circumstances. And so that's what this bill attempts to do. It sets up a process very similar to the one that occurs now for members of Congress and the state legislature for special elections to occur, given that there is a certain amount of time before that that elected official's term is up, and for matters of the legislature, it is particularly engaged when the legislature is in session and there is a vacancy. So, for example, when there was, when we don't have a special election, is when someone resigns from the legislature and the legislature is not due to convene before that term is up, but instead there's going to be a general election. So we don't, if somebody resigns in June in a general election year, we do not have a special election some 6 weeks later when the legislature is not intended to convene. Instead, there's, in a sense, a special election on the general election year, and that happened for two of our members in this past election when the Senate was not up. The elections that were taking place on the general election day for the Senate were actually special elections, but they were simultaneous with the regular election. That would not happen for the U.S. Senate. And what I did to try and indicate how this election would take place was develop a timeline for a U.S. senator whose term began in the 2006 election and would end in the 2012 election. Let's say, for example, that a vacancy would occur on January 1st of 2009. Now, we've noticed across the country, and this also was one of the reasons why I was looking at this, that there were a number of invitations to members of the U.S. Senate to join a new presidential administration. So there were going to be new senators for whatever given amount of time coming from at least four or five different states. So let's say that one of those folks resigned as of January 1st, 2009, and their term would end January 5th, 2013. So if they were ordinarily running in, they would run in 2012 for a new term if they were going to still stay in there. So that's when they would be out of office. So what would happen under this bill then, just like in the other elections, that the governor would be required to issue a writ of the vacancy. I think it is the it is done by a writ of the governor, just like it would be for a member of the legislature or Congress. And he would have to do that within 5 days of the person indicating that they had resigned the office after that effective date. So if the vacancy occurred on January 1st, then the governor would issue a writ on January 5th. And then there would be 80 days for an election to be held. So that, and actually, let's pretend instead that the vacancy occurred on January 5th, because that's how I've done my timeline. So the writ would be issued by January 10th of 2009. And then there would be an election called and held between 80 days and 100 days. And in those states that have special elections to fill a U.S. Senate position, that is a common time span. Some have longer, but that's pretty typical. So that would mean that 80 days would be April 19th, and it would be on a Tuesday. And 100 days would be April 29th. So an election could take place, depending upon the governor's decision, if it was this year, on either Tuesday, April 14th, the 21st, or the 29th. That would give you some idea of the time period, and he could choose either one of those. The earliest primary date, if there were more than
one candidate from any party, would be on March 3rd. In addition, so that would be how that process would work, and that person would then serve until the general election of 2010, which is the next general election for, so rather than being appointed from January 5th of 2009 to the general election of 2010, they would be elected by the people. And but there, just like there is an exception in the one of the things that we ran into with the death of Senator Wellstone was not only did that election in that year become a special election, the part of the statute that I've looked at about who would serve in that position from the election day through the end of December wasn't particularly clear of whether that was a general election or a special election. And so Governor Ventura decided that he had the prerogative of appointing someone to fill out the rest of that term before the new senator took office. And he appointed
Dean Barkley
to serve out that term. And then Senator Coleman took office in January of the following year for which he was elected. And what my bill would do would be that if there is a vacancy that is declared after July 1 of 2012, which is the end of that term, there would be no special election prior to the general election, but the person who won the general election would immediately become the United States Senator from the state of Minnesota. And what that would, the effect of that would be that we would, there would be a very minimal time in which we would not have a representative, we would not have a U.S. Senator, and also whoever won that election, who was going to go on to that six-year term beginning on January of that year, by being able to immediately step into the U.S. Senate and be sworn into office, would have a two-month seniority advantage over other senators who are other candidates across the country who were being elected on that date. So I think it is a procedure to consider. Right now, if Minnesota current law says that if there's a vacancy that occurs six weeks before a regular primary, then a special election is held in November. There is a long history to start with of the people not having a say-so on who the United States senators were anyway, and that those were decided by the state legislatures. And then we went to an election of them, but still giving someone else, a single individual, the right to appoint in a vacancy rather than having a vote of the people. So I believe that Minnesota should become the 15th state to allow for special election when there is a permanent vacancy occurring more than what it would be 4 months before a general election.
Senator Rest, we have a small technical amendment on line 2.3. After the word held, insert the word on.
2.3.
So it will read, and the special election.
Thank you.
Held
that would
on.
Be my amendment.
Senator Rest makes that motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion is adopted.
Senator Marty. For questions?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, the only question I had was the 80 to 100 days. I know you said that was standard. I remember a number of years ago, maybe it was Senator Clark's election was, I'm thinking, 3 days after Christmas or something. Mm-hmm. 1 day after Christmas. Anyway, I think sometimes the governor might try and pin it right there, but if you only have 3 weeks, three Tuesdays that fall in that period, depending on how it ends up, you might have one like 4 or 5 days before Christmas to 3 days after New Year's or so. And I just wondered if maybe, I don't know how many days it takes to prepare an election between the day it's called, whether it should be 70 to 100 days or 80 to 110 days. I just thought if there's a little more flexibility, if you're trying to keep it away from holidays.
Madam Chair, I don't have any objection to that. The in other states, as examples, there are the state of Alabama calls for the election on the first Tuesday after 60 days that the writ or the vacancy is officially declared. In Alaska, they use 60 to 90 days following the vacancy. In Arkansas, they use 120 days. So you can see where I was going with this. Some states, California has no schedule. I think we need a schedule. Massachusetts has between 145 and 160 days. I think that gets to be too much because it gets to be too close to the next year when a general election would be anyway. But if you wanted to have a little bit more flexibility there, even on the short side, I think that would be fine.
Madam Chair, Marty? I'm wondering if any election officials is 70 days too short of a period of time?
Mr. Mansky is shaking his head no.
And Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I'd love to move to strike 80 and insert 70 on line 2.3.
Senator Marty moves that amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Senator Rest moves that Senate File 278, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Rest. And there being no more business before the committee is adjourned.